and welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA Anchorage and travel to different spots throughout our community to listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans. This week, President of the Economic Strategy Institute, Clyde Prestowitz. Hosted by the Alaska World Affairs Council, his talk on the betrayal of American prosperity, free market delusions, America's decline, and how we must compete in the post-dollar era was recorded in Anchorage on May 3rd.
Good afternoon, everyone. Hello, good afternoon. My name is Lisa Falsko. I'm CEO of the Alaska World Affairs Council. And if I could have your attention. Thank you for coming today. We have an exciting program. So if everyone could turn off their cell phones, today's program is being recorded for the radio, as always. Thank you so much, William Toyer, for doing the recorder. And KSKA will have this available on their website, and you can listen to it at another day, as well as all of our previous programs. And this time I'd like to bring Alice Rogoff, also a board member and publisher of Alaska Dispatch, to the podium to introduce our speaker. Alice.
Friends and fellow inquisitive minds, we're really lucky to have Clyde here today. As we all know, we're living in one of the more puzzling chapters of American history, although they tell me every generation says that. So I guess the way to say that is a new puzzle in puzzling chapters in American history. And Clyde certainly has been on the front lines of this one in terms of exploring global trade and commerce. And we, as Alaskans who sit here at the epicenter of the world's commerce between air travel and soon-to-be North Pole shipping channel, are quite frankly in the bullseye of all that. So, Clyde, over to you.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here in Alaska and in Anchorage. Well, you know, it's great to look out the window here and see the mountains, because up until this moment, I was convinced that Alaska was a cloud. I was in Juneau the last couple of days, and it was a cloud. I flew up here in a cloud. Yesterday was a cloud. My wife called me this morning. She's in Washington, D.C. We're in full spring in Washington, D.C. Azaleas are out, redwoods are out, dogwoods are out. And she's flying today. In fact, she's in the air now. She's flying today to Maui. And about a year ago, actually, I was in February, a year ago, I was invited to speak at an event in Maine. I was in Maui. I was invited to speak in Maine. And, you know, it was 30 below zero in Maine and snowing. And my wife at that time said to me, why do you want to go to Maine? You know, you're in Maui. And I said, well, they seem like nice people. And so I went. So this morning, she calls me. She's gone to Maui. And she says, well, how do the people seem in Alaska? I said, well, they seem like nice people. And so it's great to be here. Thank you very much. Let me get right to it. I want to say essentially two things today. One is a theme that I have been pursuing for quite a long time, really ever since about 1981, so for a little over 30 years. And that is the theme of declining American competitiveness. I first went to Washington in the fall of 1981 as part of the Reagan administration. I was counselor to the Secretary of Commerce. My first day on the job, I walked into the secretary's office. Malcolm Baldrige was the secretary, so I walked in. Okay, Mac, here I am. Tell me, what's my job? And he said, Clyde, your job is to reduce the trade deficit. Now, in 1981, the American trade deficit was $27 billion annually. Just to put that in perspective, just yesterday, the official statistics came out for the U.S. trade deficit in March, which was $38 billion. And that was down. That the newspaper headline was trade deficit down by 11%. The trade deficit was expected in March to be about $43 billion, and it was only $38 billion for 1 month. Well, in 1981, it was $27 billion for the year. And people were saying it's unsustainable, we can't do it, it's impossible, something's got to be done about it. And so Secretary Baldrige told me my job was to reduce the trade deficit. So I said, fine. By the way, what do I get paid in this job? And I forget the number, but I remember it was a lot less than my wife and kids had become accustomed to. And so I mentioned this to Baldrige, and he said not to worry. He was a businessman himself. He understood entrepreneurial spirit, so he would make me a deal. The Commerce Department would pay me a bonus, 10% of the amount by which I reduce the trade deficit. So by 1985, the trade deficit was $150 billion. I owed Baldrige $15 billion. I had to start writing books. So I went to, in 1981, America was the world's largest creditor nation. We were a creditor to the world to the tune of about $3 trillion. We were the leader in virtually every area of technology. We still had a semiconductor industry, an electronics industry, a machine tool industry, and so forth. And I've watched over the past 30 years as the U.S. has become the world's largest debtor to the tune of about $6 trillion to the world. And let's make a distinction here. When I'm talking about debt, I'm talking international debt, what the United States owes to other countries. Not our federal debt, not our national debt, but our international debt. And that's $6 trillion. And we're the world champ in owing internationally. When I went to Washington, the dollar, you could go to Tokyo, and you got 280 yen for your dollar. Today, you get about 100 yen. I was actually in Tokyo last month, and I got 77 yen for my dollar. So, been a huge shift in the relative exchange rates. In the United States, we no longer make machine tools, hardly. We are not in the electronics business, mostly. We've lost a lot of the semiconductor industry. And many, many other industries have moved offshore or have just disappeared altogether. I talk about the betrayal of American prosperity. And this is an important concept to look at because if you look at our statistics, overall GDP, our GDP today is a lot bigger than it was 30 years ago, 10 years ago, 5 years ago. We've had growth in GDP. And if you look at GDP per capita, in fact, just before coming here, I just quickly glanced at Google, and I looked at the international rankings of GDP per capita, which countries have the highest GDP per capita. And if you do that, you get the CIA fact book or the World Bank listing. And what you see is that, I mean, countries like Norway, Luxembourg, Liechtenstein always have the highest GDP per capita. You know, they're around $80,000 or $90,000 per capita. But if you look at, you know, what I call real countries, US, Japan, Germany, countries like that, US is highest. And so we typically tell ourselves, we tell the world that we are the richest country in the world, we have the highest GDP per capita in the world. But you know what, if you just do a little exercise, and if you take out of the rankings, the top 2 or 3% of the income distribution. So take out the richest people in the country, the richest 3% in every country. Take them out of the distribution and then do the comparison. U.S. is not first. U.S. is like number 12. So what that's telling you is that 97% of Americans are less prosperous than 97% of Germans or French or Japanese or whoever, because we have such a huge disparity in between rich and middle class and lower incomes in the United States. And that gap is growing and has been growing for a long time. So another way to look at it is to say, what has happened to the median income, not the average income, not the mean, but the median income in the United States over the past 30 years? And the answer is nothing. The answer is that the median income today is just about what it was in 1970 in inflation-adjusted terms. And so we haven't actually gained in prosperity. In fact, we've lost in prosperity. And this is a theme that I've been singing, as I said, for a long time. And so the question obviously is, well, how come? What's going on? A lot of things are going on. Let me hit what I think are three or four of the major issues. One is that our national priority, you know, think about when the president, whoever he is or she is, gets up in the morning, what does he or she think is the most important thing that has to be done today, or the most important thing that has to be done in my administration? And for a long time in the United States, the answer has been national security. The answer has been to, you know, stop the Russians, defend against the North Koreans, fight Al-Qaeda. It's always national security. The top priority of the United States is national security. And in order to achieve what we define as national security, we have been willing to subordinate our economic interests. So let me give you an example of what I mean. In the mid-1980s, when I was in the Commerce Department, we were having a growing trade deficit. I was owing Baldrige more and more money. We were having a lot of trade disputes because many of our corporations and labor unions were complaining that the trade was unfair. Other countries were subsidizing their producers or dumping their products in the U.S. market, and that was unfair, and we should do something about it. And so the White House concluded that, yes, we should do something about it, and President Reagan created what we call the strike force. The job of the strike force was to seek out unfair trade wherever it might be and smite it down. And who do you think became chairman of the strike force? It was me. So my job was to, with a flaming sword, find unfair traders and cut them up. So we looked around for a good first example. We wanted to make the first target, really visible and to create an example. And there was the European Airbus. Now, go back to the late 1980s. I see a few gray hairs here. And you remember, we used to have three major commercial aircraft producers, Boeing, Douglas, and Lockheed in the United States. And those three producers accounted for about 85% of global commercial aircraft sales. But the Airbus had been, Airbus Industries had been established by the European Union. It was being subsidized. The Europeans decided that, by golly, they were going to produce airplanes too. Now, at that time, it was not economic to produce airplanes in Europe. I mean, the Americans were producing large numbers of airplanes. They had economies of scale. They had more advanced technology. So for the Europeans to get into this business was not a matter of free markets and free trade and European entrepreneurs coming up with new technology to challenge the Americans. It was a matter of the Europeans subsidizing the Airbus to catch up to the Americans. And those subsidies under international trade agreements were, technically speaking, illegal and made the Airbus a target for trade action if the U.S. Was prepared to take some trade action. And so I and my strike force, we saw the Airbus, we said, let's go get the Airbus. And I mean, it was an open and shut case. All you had to do was pick up the European press, and they listed every day, you know, all of the special deals that the Airbus was getting. So we put together our case, and before actually initiating a formal action, we took it to the White House to get approval by the president and his cabinet. So we met in the Roosevelt Room of the White House. I made the presentation. It was open and shut. And then, to my utter surprise, up jumped Secretary of State George Shultz, slammed his hand on the table, and he said, absolutely not. If we do this, it'll shatter NATO. Now, the Airbus was largely a French undertaking. At that time, the French were not in NATO. They were part of the political organization of NATO, but not the military command structure. De Gaulle had pulled the French out of NATO in the late 1960s and adopted what he called an all-azimuth target. So presumably, the Americans were as much a target of French missiles as the Russians. But Shultz said, shatter NATO, and that stopped the deal. We didn't do anything against the Airbus. Today, Lockheed and Douglas are gone. Boeing remains. Airbus has a bigger share of the global aviation market than Boeing. And it didn't get there because the Airbus is more naturally competitive. European labor is not less expensive than American labor. It's not more productive. Airbus got there because they were heavily subsidized and the U.S. government did not react. And the U.S. government did not react because our priority was NATO, not our aircraft industry. I could go on, but you get the idea. So now a second problem is that we have adopted what I call false doctrines. What do I mean by false doctrine? One example would be General Billy Mitchell after World War I. Mitchell was an Army general who recognized after World War I, so we're talking 1920, that the day of the battleship was over. And he began preaching air power. And the admirals in the Navy at that time had all gotten their admiral stripes as battleship captains. They'd all gone to Annapolis and you know, the Naval War College, and they'd all studied battleships. They loved battleships. And here's this upstart Army general saying, battleships, forget it. It's airplanes. And they, you know, nobody listened to him. He was terribly criticized. He eventually was court-martialed, actually. But at one point, he persuaded the Navy to give him two old German battleships that we had captured in the course of the war so that he could do a demonstration and show them. And so he sank each of those battleships with one bomb. Didn't matter, they court-martialed him, threw him out of the Army. It wasn't until Pearl Harbor that suddenly the upper echelons of the American military recognized that, hey, you know, it really was air power, it wasn't going to be battleships. I mean, thank God the Japanese never understood that. You know, the Japanese hung with battleships too long. Thank God. But anyhow, you know, that was an example of a false doctrine. Let me give you another one that more of you will remember, I'm sure. Remember in Vietnam, we had a doctrine called the domino theory. The idea was that if Vietnam went communist, all of Indochina, nay, all of Southeast Asia, nay, all of Asia, really all the whole world, would go communist. So we had to make a stand in Vietnam and stop the rot right there, right? Now, you know, we look back at that from the perspective of 2013 today. What a stupid doctrine. What a superficial, idiotic doctrine, right? But I was there. Everybody believed it. You couldn't get a job in a high government position. You couldn't get tenure at any leading university. You couldn't write for a leading newspaper if you didn't more or less toe the party line, domino theory. And it wasn't until 55,000 kids, American kids, had been killed, and hundreds of thousands of Vietnamese, that we recognized what a dumb idea it was. False doctrine. Now, the people who held these doctrines, the admirals in Billy Mitchell's time, our leaders in the time of Vietnam, they weren't stupid. Mac Bundy, President Kennedy's national security advisor, you know, thought to be one of the brightest deans Harvard had ever had. These were the best and the brightest. That was the title of David Halberstam's famous book about Vietnam. It's possible for very smart people and large numbers of them to glom onto a bad idea and make it a false doctrine for a long time. And that's what we have done in our economics in a number of areas. Let me give you an example. We've been through a financial crisis beginning in 2008. In 2007, I attended a conference in India at which there was a very, very bright Indian financial analyst. And he said that he had been looking at these derivative instruments. And that he had been trying to track the risk, find the counterparties in the deals, and he couldn't find them. And he said, you know, there's $47 trillion worth of this stuff out there. And he said, you know, nobody knows what the risk is. If anything happens, they're not going to be able to find the counterparties. It's going to be a disaster. So about a month after that, I was at a conference in Washington at which the main speaker was the vice chairman of Lehman Brothers. So we're talking December 2007. And this guy was just as happy as he could be. The economy was fantastic. Lehman Brothers was making money hand over fist. Wall Street was making money hand over fist. Housing prices were soaring. Everybody was taking mortgages. You know, we had the famous ninja mortgages, no income, no job. But his forecast was that everything was just beautiful. And I raised my hand. I said, Tom, I was at this conference in India, and a really bright guy made this point about nobody can find their risk. And he said, Clyde, you're not an expert in these things. He said, look, we have our value at risk models, our sophisticated computer models, and we have stress tested our system upside down, backwards, inside out. It works. Clyde, go home, you know, take a nap, be happy. Well, a year later, there was no Lehman Brothers. There was no Tom. What happened? Yeah, they had sophisticated models. There are two problems with the models. It's always in the assumptions. You know, the models are sophisticated. The mathematics is elegant. Always look for the assumptions. So one element of the model, of these models, is that they model a market. And if you want to model a market so that it's absolutely predictable, you know, like physics. I mean, you know, if you take that cup and put something in it and heat it, a physicist can predict the rate at which the heat will expand with absolute certainty. Well, a market, after all, is made up of human beings. So human beings often act like that cup, but sometimes they don't. The models were based, honest to God, the models were based on the heat distribution properties of cups, basically. And it assumed that the molecules, in this case, the people in the markets, would all react always in the same way to the same stimulus. Well, they don't. 99% of the time they might, but they don't always. Second problem was that the model assumed that you could always sell your position at some price, maybe at a discount, but at some price you could get out. Well, in a panic, you can't sell at any price. That's why you need TARP and bad banks and government intervention, because you can't sell. You need a buyer of last resort, because you can't sell at any price in a panic market. And that's what happened to Lehman Brothers, and that's what happened to our financial system, because it was based on false assumptions, false doctrines. Well, let me just hit one third false doctrine, and that is the doctrine of free trade. Now, I'm willing to bet, if I take a poll, I say, how many people here are for free trade? I'll bet you everybody will raise their hand. But if I say to you, what do you mean by free trade? So I guess that if I say free trade, most of you have in mind a system under which the American market is open to imports from abroad, and the markets of our trading partners are open to our exports. They don't have any tariffs, we don't have any tariffs, they don't subsidize, we don't subsidize, they don't have excessive cartels, we don't have excessive cartels, we don't discriminate against their products, their corporations, they don't discriminate. So reciprocal. I guess you probably, if you say you're for free trade, you probably have in mind reciprocal free trade. That's not what American policy is based upon. That's not what economists mean when they say free trade. What economists mean when they say free trade is unilateral free trade. Even if the other guy is subsidizing his industries, putting rocks in his harbors so the ships can't get in to bring the imports in, even if he's keeping his markets sealed shut, nevertheless, you should keep your market open for his goods and his services, because he's giving your consumers a gift. I'll give you just one example of this. In the mid-1980s, a company called Siemens Alice, joint venture between Siemens and Alice Chalmers, came to see me. They made hydro generators. And they had this interesting set of data which showed that, you know, maybe in December, the state of Oregon would let a bid for hydro generators. Now, there are about 10 producers in the world, so there'd be 10 bids. Now, all the bids would be in about, you know, $5 million, 5.1, 5.2. But Japanese company A would be in at $2.5 million. Next month, state of California let a bid. Same equipment, same companies, 10 bids. This time, Japanese company B is in at $2.5 million. So there's this pattern of, obviously, the Japanese were underbidding and passing the bid around. And Alice Chalmers was saying, hey, look, if this continues, we can't stay in business. We're going to have to get out of business. So you guys at the Commerce Department should do something. And I kind of agree with that, so I began to put together the basis for an action, but I knew it was going to be difficult, because I knew that the State Department would be against taking any action, because their main objective was to keep things cozy with Japan for national security reasons. I knew that the Treasury Department wouldn't like it, because their main objective was to keep the financial markets with Japan stable and nice. I knew the Pentagon desperately wouldn't like it, because the Pentagon's main objective in Japan is bases and Japanese cooperation with the 7th Fleet and the U.S. Forces in the Far East. And I knew that the Council of Economic Advisors probably would be against it, because they embrace unilateral free trade. But I had what I thought was an ace in the hole. One of the members of the council was the brother of my college roommate. I said, well, if I talk to Bill, you know, maybe I can talk sense to Bill. So I go see Bill. and I tell him the story. And he says, Clyde, what's the problem? He says, states are getting cheap hydro generators, generating cheap electricity, customers are getting cheap electricity, everybody's better off. It's a gift. They're giving us a gift. I said, well, Bill, wait a minute. You know, they're going to have to close this hydro generator plant they have in Aliquippa, Pennsylvania, lay off 150,000 people or so. Don't worry, Clyde, don't worry. We have the services industry is booming. Now they can get jobs at McDonald's or, you know, at the local hospital emergency service or something. Don't worry. I said, okay, Bill, look, what happens when the Japanese drive everybody out of the business then they begin charging the prices they charge in Japan? Because in Japan, they have a cartel, and the prices are 2 or 3 times what they are in the U.S. Oh, he said, if they do that, then the American companies can come back into the business. Now, this guy became the president of the St. Louis Federal Reserve Bank. I mean, he's not a dumb guy. PhD from University of Chicago, not a dumb guy, very bright guy, false doctrine. And that is the false doctrine on which our trade policy is predicated. Right now, we're negotiating so-called TPP, Trans-Pacific Partnership, with Japan and I guess what, 10 other countries. You know, I can guarantee, I mean, that deal will be sold to the U.S. Congress, the administration, and, you know, what's interesting is I've been through a lot of administrations now, and it doesn't matter, Republican, Democrat, doesn't matter. Every administration takes these trade deals up to the Congress and tells the Congress it's going to open these markets for American products. It's going to create more exports, going to reduce our trade deficit. Can you imagine when China joined the WTO, World Trade Organization, in the late 1990s, early 2001-2002, the U.S. Trade Representative, other leaders of the administration went up to the Congress and they said, this will reduce our trade deficit with China. Now, at that time, our trade deficit with China was about $10 billion a year. Today, it's about $200 billion a year. It never reduces the trade deficit because we're not playing the same games. They're playing a strategic catch-up game, just like the Europeans were with Airbus. We're not playing that game, and we never understand that. And so the result of all of these false doctrines has been this betrayal of American prosperity. But let me leave you with some hope, because I have, honestly, frankly speaking, I've been a crier of gloom and doom for so long that I'm cried out. And I need some hope myself. And so let me try to cheer us up together, okay? Group therapy. Actually, I recently completed a tour. I did an around-the-world trip. And I got back. I said to my wife, I said, you know, we got problems. But boy, so do those other guys. Go to Japan. And you've heard about Japan's 2 decades of lost growth, and you've heard about stagnation, and the new prime minister is trying to create some inflation. But think about this for a minute. Japan today is a country of 127 million people. On present trends, Japan's population by 2050, so within 37 years, will be down to 88 million people. And over half of those people will be over 65. Japan, you think we have a high national debt. Our national debt's about 90% of GDP. Japan's is 200%. Japan's a country with some real problems. Skip across the ocean and stop in Korea. Korea's aging rate is faster than Japan's. Korea's birth rate is lower than Japan's. Korea has no future either unless they can turn that around. China, we all have been looking at China as the current Asian miracle is China. 10% growth, now down to about 8% growth. And China will continue to grow at, for a while, at, I believe, about 7%. But China's growth rate is declining, and there are a number of reasons for that. But a big part of it is that when you're in China, you are in a continual haze. You know, China always looks like Anchorage looked yesterday. You can only see kind of across the street, or not even. I mean, I have actually had the experience of waking up in the morning at my hotel in China and looking out the window and going back to bed because I thought it was still nighttime. So the environmental degradation, the loss of fresh water capacity, all of these are huge problems. And China's population is also beginning to shrink. China's labor force shrank this year for the first time, and it will continue to shrink for the next 50 years on present trajectory. So China will, the big question for the last 20 years has been, will China get rich before it gets old? And the answer, I believe, is no. China is getting old, and it's not yet rich. And so that's an issue. Then I went to India, and India is, you know, another Asian miracle of a somewhat different stripe, but India growing at 5-6%, and it'll continue to grow. But this is a country that's whose politics are more dysfunctional than ours. It's a country fraught, burdened down with corruption. One of the best-selling books in India these days, the title is India Grows at Night. And it's a bestseller in India, and the reason is because the government is not operating at night. And so if they can get rid of the government, then it can grow. And so that's the title of the book. And it's really, you know, it's really appropriate. You know, and then you go to Europe. And I mean, I'm a longtime Europhile. I lived in Europe many years. I love Europe. But the Europeans are in a real pot of trouble. And then they're not going to get out of it easily. So you come back to the U.S., and you know, I've often said that it wasn't that the Americans won the Second World War, it was that the Germans lost it. And that's kind of, I think, where we are. It's not that we're winning, but it's that the other guys have big problems, too. So if I look at the U.S. today, our demographics are pretty good. We have continued immigration. Our population will continue to grow at about 1-1.5% per year. Which is, you know, much better than all the other major countries. We have just, you know, really struck it rich in this bonanza of shale oil and shale gas. We will become the price setter in energy. We will become the major energy producer, and we'll be the low-cost place for energy-intensive industries to produce. The dollar is going to remain the world's major currency for the foreseeable future. That's very important because it means we can borrow in our own currency. We're not subject to, so we have $6 trillion in international debt, and I wish we didn't, but it's in dollars. Worst comes to the worst, we can just print more of them. It's not, you know, like it's not like being Korea, and you hold your reserves in dollars, and if you don't have enough dollars, you're finished. So that's a big advantage for us. We have the world's most powerful military. I actually wish that we didn't use it so much, but you know, it's still better to be strong than weak. And we have another thing that has really been fascinating to me. This is so-called three-dimensional printing. This is a revolutionary technology that I think is a real game changer. What it means is that, you know, if you take the printer on your computer, you know how that works. Well, that can be done in three dimensions. You can pile up layers of printing, and you can, the layers don't have to be ink. They can be metals or plastics or other things. So so a 3D printer can produce complex forms that are virtually impossible to produce in a normal manufacturing machine tool process. And the 3D printer can print these inexpensively just from cartridge. You put an ink cartridge in your computer printer. Well, you just put cartridges in a 3D printer of the right materials, and it can produce an automobile engine or whole houses actually have been built by 3D printers. Now, for the United States, what this means is that you know, we've had this big offshoring of production to China, to places with cheap labor. Well, with a 3D printer, you don't need huge capital investment. And then the cost of transportation becomes very important. So actually, the tendency is to move production to the location of demand. And so what I see is a return of production, or if not a return, at least an increase of domestic production to satisfy domestic demand. And if you consider that our trade deficit, which right now is running at about $450 billion annually, consider that that trade deficit costs us, the United States costs us, depending on how you count, but anywhere from 4 to 8 million jobs. So if you get rid of that trade deficit and pick up 4 to 8 million jobs, that has to be good for the economy. And so I think that's all very hopeful, but let me leave you with this warning. Some of you probably play bridge. And you know that, I mean, if I think of international economics as a game of bridge, and I say, whose hand would I like to play? Would I like to play the EU hand? No, not really. Would I like to play the Chinese hand? Oh, that'd be more fun, but that's still pretty tough. No, the US has the best hand. We have the best hand. But one of the frustrating things about bridge is that you can have the best hand and still lose if you play the cards badly. How do I know this? I do it all the time. And so right now, you know, I would say as a country, problem with us is that we're playing the cards just about as badly as we can play them. Our politics are dysfunctional, the incentives in our corporate systems are perverse, our educational system is got huge problems. We're just not playing the cards well. And so, people talk about, there's been a rash of books published in the last year about the Asian century, the rise of China, the rise of the rest. Fareed Zakaria has a book, The Post-American Era, in which he talks about the rise of the rest. I think this century, could well be a new American century, but only if we play the cards well. Thank you very much.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you're listening to Addressing Alaskans with Clyde Prestowitz, president of the Economic Strategy Institute. Hosted by the Alaska World Affairs Council, his talk on the betrayal of American prosperity, free market delusions, America's decline, and how we must compete in the post-dollar era was recorded in Anchorage on May 3rd. Following his presentation, Clyde responded to questions from the audience.
Thank you for the last part. Now, imagine a state trooper goes out on a bridge and sees a guy ready to jump, and he says, "What's the problem?" And he says, "I just listened to Clyde talk, and I'm worried about dysfunctional government shooting herself in the foot." But
right.
the trooper says, "Tell you what, take 5 minutes and tell me why life isn't worth living, and I'll take my 5 minutes." And after 10 minutes, they both jump.
Right.
So my question for you is, who is going to lead us through this period of hope? I mean,
right.
The politicians
right.
seem to help get us, lead
right.
us to where we are.
Right.
How do we lead ourselves and
right.
led to where we need to be?
Right. Well, I think you just said the word. How do we lead ourselves? Who's going to lead us? Us. Our politicians respond to us. Now, the problem, as I see it, and I've been watching this now for 30 years, a little more in Washington, is that the Our politicians respond to their constituents. But ask yourself, who are their constituents? And the answer is, at the moment, their most important constituents are corporations and rich guys. Because the system is now so gerrymandered that the real election is not the general election. The seats are safe. In most cases. I mean, I saw a recent estimate that in the House of Representatives, only about 60 of the 435 seats in the House are really contestable. All the rest of them are safe seats. So if you have a safe seat, the real election is not the general election, it's the primary. And in the primary election, representatives who hold safe seats are vulnerable to challenge because very few people vote in primaries. And so a well-organized challenging campaign, well-financed, can knock out an incumbent. And we've seen that in the last round of elections. And they can knock out that incumbent because, as I said, well-financed. So, rich people, rich corporations with an agenda can go after, and the representatives respond to that constituent because that's the most important constituent. So what I think is incumbent upon us is a wide, broadly based public movement to redistrict, and even I would, it's, what I'm proposing is probably may not be possible, but I would like to see a constitutional amendment on districting, so that all states are districted the same way, and they're all based on the same principles of districting, so that you don't get these weird districts that, you know, look like fish or bears or snakes or whatever the hell they are. The second thing I would like to see is that we dramatically reduce the amount of money in politics. Canadians can run a national campaign in 6 weeks in under $1 billion. Every country in the world can do that except us. We run campaigns that last for 2.5 years and cost $100 billion. I've just seen it again in my time in Washington. We talk about K Street as the heart of the lobbying industry, and it has just, it's been the biggest growth industry in the country for the past 30 years. The amount of money that goes through that place is just unbelievable. And it's, again, think of Canada. In Canada, only a natural person can make a political donation. In the U.S., we call corporations persons, and we give them the same rights as a natural person. Think about a corporation. A corporation has eternal life. It kind of goes on forever. It's an American citizen, but it can also be a French, German, Japanese, Chinese citizen. It has unlimited resources in many cases. So it's a super person. And I think we need to redress that balance. I think that's the heart of our dysfunctional politics.
Thank you, sir. I have both a positive and or negative question and then a positive question. The negative one: last week I heard a speaker, ironically from Finland, who pointed out the fact that the income disparity in this country is at its most dramatic point since 1776, and I'd like to get your comment on that. And the second part, the positive piece, is I'm happy to say that right here in our Anchorage School District at our Diamond High School Engineering Academy, students are learning how to use those 3D printers, and they're learning how to make things right now. And do you see that technology use and the positive, innovative spirit of America being the piece that pulls us out of this?
Yeah, well, let me answer the first last. You see the revolutionary nature of 3D printing. It's just really fantastic. Having said that, we are not necessarily in the U.S. at the cutting edge. I mean, we're there, but China, Korea, Germany are all running fast as well. And so again, we need to play our cards properly. Yeah, income disparity, you know, I don't know the exact numbers, but certainly, I mean, we are in the, and there's a thing called the Gini Index, which is used internationally to measure income disparity. And historically, the countries with the biggest income disparities have been Brazil, South Africa, Mexico. The U.S. now ranks, is in that category. We're just a little bit less disparate than Brazil. And that's not good company to be in.
We have the USS Anchorage in town. It's going to be commissioned, I think, on Saturday. I joined the throng touring it yesterday. And I was, you know, I was really astounded by the high-tech navigational, operational, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I come from a naval background of a couple of years on a communication ship in the 1950s in the with the amphibious forces, a World War II leftover. But this thing is reported to have cost $1 billion.
All right. It's like, you know, when you take your BMW to be fixed, that nothing can be fixed for less than $1,000. And it's kind of like that. $1 billion is the, you know, the beginning price for everything.
You know, if I don't know if you'd be interested in taking a look, but they might. It's astonishing. And one of these can only do so much. And in the big picture, it's damned little.
Yeah, well, I think that, you know, as I mentioned earlier, the U.S. Puts an enormous effort into being the hegemonic power. We spend, I mean, U.S. military spending is greater than the rest of the world combined. And, you know, I guess what always strikes me is that, as you said, you know, this thing is full of high tech. Shoot one missile, that's $1 million. And we, you know, we easily do that. And yet, in my view, you know, we struggle with ourselves to spend $1 million on our schools. I don't know, something happened when I was coming up from Juneau the other day. I just mentioned this, and it's kind of a, you know, maybe I'm a little too sensitive, but, you know, when you get on an airplane, you know, the gate opens, and the flight attendant starts boarding, and typically, people who are in the elite airline clubs, for United, it's global services. You know, first class, global services, people with handicaps, board first. Who else boards first? Uniformed military. And thank you for your service. And I thought, you know, I was in the diplomatic service. I served my country. Why don't we board diplomats? And thank you for your service. But just an indication of, I'm not trying to be disrespectful of veterans. I respect veterans. I serve myself. But I just wonder about the balance of that. And, you know, what you're saying about the cost is, I think, commensurate with that.
Thank you for speaking, Mr. Speaker.
Can't hear you.
Can you hear me now?
A little bit better.
How about now?
That's good.
You talk about Washington being the number one concern in Washington to be national security. You talk about bailouts. You also talk about how the United States has helped so many other countries in this war. For instance, Kuwait, Iraq, you know, Afghan, and all these other places. The United States is faced with closing down schools in Chicago and other parts of the states, and have helped in the past so many other nation states out there. What do you think the United States should do? We're in debt with China right now, and there is all that money that has been put into other nations by helping them out. Do you think that the United States should try to negotiate something like saying, we have done so much for you. What are we getting back for this? What's your concern?
Well, let me attack it in a little bit different way. I don't actually think that the U.S. has done a lot for other countries. I mean, if you look at the amount of aid that we give, it's peanuts. What the U.S. has done that has dramatically helped other countries has been to open its market, and so the producers in other countries have been able to sell into the huge American market and thereby gain economies of scale that they wouldn't get in their own markets. We didn't do that as a gift to the foreign countries. We did that as part of our economic doctrine and as part of trying to hold prices down in the U.S. for American consumers. The other thing that we've done is to spend enormous amounts in other countries on military operations. I mean, Japan's recovery from World War II was really based on American military spending done in Japan in connection with the Korean War. Afghanistan. I mean, you look at the amount of money Americans have dropped in Afghanistan in the past 10 years in carrying out the activities against Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. So my view is that countries have typically gotten rich. Look at Singapore or Korea or Japan or any of the countries that have gotten rich in the last 30, 40 years have not gotten rich as a result of aid. They've gotten rich as a result of trade and as a result of foreign investment and domestic investment. Actually, I think that the emerging markets today are in pretty good shape in terms of their ability to continue to emerge and grow. I don't think that they need really special American help. In fact, I would do it the other way around. I'm a strong believer in nation building at home. And I would like to reduce the American commitment abroad and increase. We have, President Obama has adopted this policy. He calls it the pivot to Asia. I'd like to pivot to America. And doesn't mean I want to withdraw from Asia entirely, but think about it. My view of it is this. There's really no threat to the United States in Asia. China is not going to invade the United States. North Korea is not going to send a missile to the U.S. They can't. We don't get our oil through the Straits of Malacca. The Asians are not going to stop selling to us. So what's the threat? There's no threat. But we're on the front line. We're committed to defend Japan and Korea. They are not committed to defend us. It's not reciprocal. I'm willing for America to play its role. I'm willing to keep the Seventh Fleet out there. But I'd like some Korean and Japanese and other boys and girls to get shot at as well as Americans. And that doesn't happen the way things are set up right now.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you've been listening to Addressing Alaskans with Clyde Prestowitz, president of the Economic Strategy Institute. He responded to audience questions following his talk entitled The Betrayal of American Prosperity, Free Market Delusions, America's Decline, and How We Must Compete in the Post-Dollar Era. Hosted by the Alaska World Affairs Council, Clyde Prestowitz was recorded speaking at the Hilton Anchorage on May 3rd, 2013.
You can download today's program or subscribe to free podcasts of Addressing Alaskans at alaskapublic.org. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to alaskapublic.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. Addressing Alaskans' theme song, Trampolines, is by Patrick Lee. This has been a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening.